found more than $100 million he'd already amassed buried in his parents' backyard. Tovia Smith, NPR News, Boston.
A panel of federal judges in San Diego considers whether to consolidate dozens of proposed class action lawsuits against the big automaker Toyota. Owners say the values of their vehicles have plummeted after millions of recalls for safety and quality fixes. The 7-judge panel will decide whether and how the cases can be consolidated or should be settled rather than tried. Toyota favors a Los Angeles court for trial, but more than 18 other jurisdictions have been suggested so far, from New Jersey to Puerto Rico. I'm Paul Brown, and this is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines.
I am Champaign-Urbana Public Health District.
Provena Covenant.
Champaign Park District.
UI Campus Recreation.
Christie Clinic.
Champaign-Urbana Mass Transit District CU Safe Routes to School Project.
I am Carl Foundation Hospital.
And I'm Molly Delaney of Illinois Public Media, and together we're CU Fit Families. Join us and many other organizations in fighting childhood obesity. Call 217-333-7300 or email delaney1@illinois.edu.
Support for programs on Illinois Public Media comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. This Saturday's wine tasting features 10 wines, running the gamut in style and geography. More information is available online at thecorkscrew.com.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus 580 archives, so as you listen, do keep in mind, we'll not be taking your calls. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with Theodore Kornweibel. He's a professor emeritus of African American history at San Diego State University, and we will be talking about a book that he has authored that's just recently come out. And the title of the book is Railroads in the African American Experience. It's published by Johns Hopkins Press. He argues that the history of American railroads cannot be separated from African American history. For more than 100 years, railroads provided the most important industrial occupation for Black Americans. And he says that these workers, brakemen, firemen, porters, chefs, mechanics, were all essential to the daily operation and success of the country's rail system. We'll talk about that in this hour of Focus. And of course, if people who are listening have questions, we'd be happy to take them. In Champaign-Urbana, here where we are, 333-9455 is the number. We also have a toll-free line so that if it's a long-distance call for you, use that number and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. We do also have email, so if you'd like to submit your question that way, question, comment that way, you can do that. That's Will, W-I-L-L, will-talk@illinois.edu. Any point here? Questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. And Professor Kornweibel, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's good to join you.
We appreciate it. I think it's interesting in the early part of the book, in the preface to the book, you explain that back in the early 90s, someone from the Railroad Museum of Pennsylvania called you and said they were interested in whether you could recommend someone to them who could talk about this subject, African Americans and the railroads. And you said, well, actually, I don't know of anybody. And when you went out looking, you discovered that the book now that you have written, there wasn't anything like this. Nobody had written this book before. Now, I'm sure there are plenty of books that should be written but aren't, but you have to wonder that I would think a subject like this, somebody would have written this book before now.
Well, bits and pieces had been written. Lots of people knew about the Pullman sleeping car porters, and that's because white Americans enjoyed the service of sleeping car porters for well over a century and were familiar with them. So they'd been written about, and similarly, dining car waiters and chefs and cooks had been written about because they were encountered in the dining cars of luxury passenger trains. But beyond that, blacks were invisible men for the most part, and during World Wars, both World Wars, invisible women as well.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that we're going to talk about here, probably one of the first things we'll talk about, is slave labor building the railroads, something that, again, maybe people wouldn't be aware of or wouldn't think about. But it's interesting, and you talk about it here in the introduction, that actually some of the railroads today would just as soon not really have that discussed.
That's true. That's true. The South's railroad system before the Civil War couldn't have been built without as extensively without slave labor. And although I wasn't able to document every one of the maybe about 120 Southern railroads before the Civil War, three-quarters of them that I have evidence for, three-quarters of them used slaves, and I presume that all used slaves, either buying slaves or renting them, what was called hiring, from plantation owners who had surplus. But slave labor deterred free labor in the South. And once the South had embarked upon relying on slave labor, it would have had literally no other ready source of labor to build its railroad system before the Civil War.
And in addition to laying track, there were slaves who were working in various other jobs around the railroad, probably everything with the exception of engineers. There were not slave engineers, but the other sorts of jobs that people have to do on the trains, in addition to building the track, were also done by slaves.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's not surprising because there were on plantations and in other industries, there were skilled slaves. So it's not surprising to find slave blacksmiths and others in railroad shops. Slave labor was used to load and unload freight. Slaves were brakemen on passenger and freight trains. That was a pretty dangerous job. They were firemen, and that could also be a dangerous job. But they could not hold the prestige positions of engineer, who drives the train, and conductor, who is the actual boss of the train, because no black person should ever be allowed to give orders to or to command the respect of a white person.
Yeah. I believe that when the first engineers union was formed, one of their basic principles was that no black men were going to be engineers. When did the first black engineers, train drivers appear?
Well, the first engineers are really lost to history, and they are a handful of people in the 19th century who somehow breached the color line, and usually on a small or industrial railroad. But in terms of the large railroads, such as we know today, it wasn't until civil rights legislation in the 1960s that the railroad companies were forced to start admitting blacks into training programs or to promote them up from the fireman ranks.
Yeah. That, you know, I'm sure people have heard these terms for the various members of the crew. I'm pretty sure that I know that the fireman was the guy who stokes the boiler. What is the job of the brakeman?
Well, in the era before the safety air brakes, which are part of today's technology, to stop a train required manually applying brakes on each car or on as many cars as possible. So it might be in the winter in the middle of a snowstorm, and if the train was heading on a downgrade, the engineer would blow the whistle and the brakeman would have to start scampering across the tops of the railroad cars. There's no railings there. You're just hopping from car to car and on each one manually turning a heavy brake wheel to set the brakes. And then when the train reached the bottom of the hill and needed the brakes off, he would have to go back and let those brakes free.
Mm.
It was a perilous job. That brakeman, probably the highest mortality rate was a brakeman who fell between cars, fell off cars, were crushed between cars when coupling cars together.
So I'm sure probably people have this memory of seeing in films, or maybe they've actually seen real trains, maybe more likely in films, there's a little ladder on the end of the car that you use to climb up to the top of the car, and then there would be a large metal wheel, kind of, you know, like a steering wheel, a big wheel. And apparently what you had to do was you had to climb up there, get on top of the car, and then manually turn that wheel, and what that would do would be to set the brakes on that car.
Correct. That's correct. You got it. So, but that wasn't the only hazard for the brakemen. The brakemen were also people who coupled and uncoupled cars, and until the invention of the modern safety knuckle coupler, such as we have today, the brakemen had to stand between two cars, and as they were pushed together by a locomotive, they had to slip pins through an iron link. It was called link and pin coupling. That was truly precarious, and they lost fingers, they lost hands, they were crushed to death between cars. So that was... And one of the reasons why blacks readily found those jobs, particularly in the South, was white men didn't want to undertake the danger. Once safety couplers were invented, then it suddenly became attractive to whites, and they decided to push blacks out of that occupation.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Theodore Kornweibel. He's a professor emeritus in African-American history at San Diego State University. He's author of a number of books, and his most recent is titled Railroads in the African-American Experience, A Photographic Journey, published by Johns Hopkins. And it does have most of the time I'm content to do this as a radio show with no visual aids, but I'm sorry that we can't show some of the pictures in the book because it has a lot of really wonderful photographs in the book. So I'm sure people who are interested in the history of railroading or interested in African-American history would find a lot of things that would be really interesting in this book. Well, questions here are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. We talked just a little bit earlier about the fact that at least in the southern part of the United States, the railroads probably could not have been built or would not have been built without significant slave labor. And that at that time, we're talking about they didn't have a lot of machinery and things to assist them in the work. It was sheer muscle power. It was sheer physical work. What would be involved in laying a line of railroad track?
Well, first of all, the basic right-of-way would have to be cleared of boulders, of trees, of... any other major obstruction. And before the invention of dynamite, all they had was black gunpowder, which was very volatile and a dangerous thing to use for blasting. To dig out a tunnel, most of it was pick and shovel work. So it was for all intents and purposes, before the Civil War, There was no machinery to assist in the arduous labor of clearing the ground, leveling it. That means that small hills, you kind of dug a cut through it, as it was called, kind of a trench through that small hill so that the railroad didn't have to hop over the hill. Then you had to lay down ties. You had to lay down rails, spike the rails to the ties, had to ballast the right-of-way, and then soon maintain it, because railroads pound rails out of alignment, and there's constant maintenance required on a railroad. So as soon as it's built, it's in the process of being maintained.
Yeah, that was something I guess I didn't really appreciate, the fact that that as a result of the trains going over the rails end up moving, particularly on curves, and that rail... maintenance gangs spend a lot of their time going around just literally by main force pushing the rails back into the place that they're supposed to be.
Today, that's all done by computerized machinery. But for decades and decades. It was track gangs leaning on heavy iron bars in unison to move rail, and heavy iron rail can be moved that way. It's darn hard work.
Yeah, and that's how it is. We have these, maybe people have now heard these recordings of old work songs. That's why we have these songs, because it meant to coordinate the effort of everybody to get everybody to lean or push or, you know, do it. It had, everybody had to do it at the same time if it was going to work.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, rich store of railroad work songs, and they're sometimes called lining bar chants, because these heavy iron bars were used to line or align the track, and they all leaned onto those bars at the same time. It's a lost art. There's a group back in Virginia called the Buckingham Lining Bar Gang, and they put on exhibitions to try and keep the tradition alive.
It was remarkably hard work, but also there are some stories in the book. I don't know how people managed to do it, that they actually lay significant lengths of track in what seemed to be sort of astoundingly short periods of time.
Yes, and in part that was because they sometimes mobilized huge gangs of workers on one project. A major construction project might have 1,000 workers, a small army. And so, yes, impressive number of miles of new track might be laid, but it was all at a physical cost.
One of the things that I think only recently have we gotten historians writing about is what happened in the South after the war, when there was no more slavery, that there was, in effect, a form of de facto slavery that still continued and continued for a long time, where railroads, for example, but other industries used convict labor as workers. And this continued now after, when there was no more slavery, that continued to be a source of workers for the railroads.
Yes, and convict labor and the making of convicts, if you will, was a deliberate substitute for slavery. Southern whites were convinced that blacks could never be worked without compulsion, and that they had to be managed by, driven by, led by a white overseer or supervisor. And so very quickly after the Civil War ended, the new Southern governments began a process of leasing out convicts to major public improvement projects, as well as mines and similar industries. And in some states, they completely emptied the prisons by leasing the convicts out, male and female, young and old, to particularly the railroads that were being rebuilt and new lines being built in the South after the Civil War.
We have a couple of callers here to talk with. Let's do that.
Great.
Starting with someone in Belgium, the community, not too far away from here. Line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. To step back just a moment in your discussion here, back to the Gandhi dancers that you were just referring to earlier that aligned the track, probably one of the most famous of all the railroaders, that black railroaders think of, is John Henry. We hear the song about John Henry a lot, and he was building a tunnel that killed him, that, you know, through the mountains. And I'm wondering, was there really a John Henry? Or
great,
is he just totally fictitious?
Great question, and we couldn't answer that question up to about 2 years ago. But there's a wonderful book written by Scott Nelson. I don't remember the exact title, but easily found. And he has proven that John Henry is not a mythical character. He was, in fact, a black Civil War soldier in the Union Army. He stuck around in the state of Virginia after the war. How he got into trouble and what the circumstances were are not clear. But it's been documented that he was building the Big Bend Tunnel on what became the Chesapeake and Ohio Railroad, that he and among many others lost their lives, and that most of the details in the song are accurate. So it's just been thrilling to have folklore become fact and history.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thanks for the call, and we'll talk to someone next in Atlanta, Illinois. Line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I've got a question concerning Gage Beck, and I might not have the time right, but it could be after the Civil War, and in that case, slavery obviously wouldn't be the prime focus of this, but it could be that black labor was an important aspect of accomplishing this. But I think mainly throughout the South, during this time that I'm thinking about, we had a lot of different gauges of railroads. In other words, the standard gauge is 4 foot, 8.5 inches, and maybe we had 5-inch gauge trains, and we had even larger gauge trains, and that made all the equipment incompatible.
Mm-hmm.
And in a matter of a couple days, they changed all the gauge from all throughout the South to a 4 foot, 8.5 inch gauge. And I've always wondered, labor-wise, how in the world they were ever to accomplish that.
Well, you're right. And that was in the later 1880s, I believe it was. It had to be accomplished very quickly, because if there was going to be compatibility between the various railroad systems, they all had to have the same gauge, the same spacing between the rails. And so massive numbers of track workers were mobilized almost literally in one weekend to move the rails or to add a third rail to get to the standard gauge. And of course, they didn't have to build new roadbed. It was simply, well, not simply, it was hard work to pull up old rails, move them over and to the correct gauge, and to spike them down. But it was truly an impressive achievement in just this one weekend that much of the South, we're talking about thousands and thousands of miles of track, the gauge changed in just that short time.
Well, were blacks involved in a lot in this?
Yes.
Obviously in the South, that they would have been a part of that tremendous undertaking.
Yes, absolutely. They were the backbone. Without black labor, it wouldn't have been possible. But I think we need to think about why blacks so readily took such jobs, hard physical jobs. And the truth of it is, and a major theme, is that railroading was about the best industrial alternative for blacks for decades and decades. If you wanted to escape sharecropping and the trap of peonage in agriculture, if you didn't want to go into domestic service, in many instances, the best opportunity was a railroad job.
Well, I appreciate your answer, and thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We're about at our midpoint of this hour of Focus 580, and let me introduce again our guest, Theodore Kornweibel. He's professor emeritus in African-American Studies, San Diego State University, author of a number of books about American history, including the newest, the one that we've been talking a little bit about here, Railroads in the African-American Experience, A Photographic Journey. And it's published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. And if you have the opportunity, you're in the bookstore, take a look at the book, because it's got a lot of great photographs in it. Questions here are welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. What was early on here, I know that people understand that under Jim Crow, facilities in the South were segregated. What did that mean for people who were riding trains, and what were the conditions for black people who were train passengers?
Well, they were to be consigned to the Jim Crow or segregated car on the train, and in most cases could not avail themselves of first-class amenities. If blacks tried to buy a Pullman compartment ticket, they often had to do so under subterfuge or have a white person purchase the ticket for them, but that wasn't even a guarantee that once they were on the train that they would be allowed to sit in the first-class car among white passengers. They couldn't go to the club or lounge car because that's where the elite went to smoke cigars and drink and socialize with, again, their own kind. And if they got a meal in the dining car at all, it was behind a curtain separating them from whites, so whites wouldn't get indigestion, presumably, from having to watch or see blacks dining. So it was a series of humiliations. And it didn't just occur in the South. You're at a major site on the Illinois Central Railroad there mm-hmm. in Champaign. Mm-hmm. And the Illinois Central sent many trains from Chicago down to New Orleans. In theory, as soon as the train entered Southern Territory in Kentucky, that's when it was supposed to be segregated. But it was the routine practice of railroads like the Illinois Central to segregate blacks from the moment they stepped on the train in Chicago, let's say. So even in the so-called free or non-Southern state, segregation still occurred.
Let's take another call. We have someone in Rantoul, line number one.
Yes, mm-hmm. I was very interested in this, and I was interested in the discussion about how slaves were used to build the railroad track in the South particularly. There's a tunnel in Oconee County in northern South Carolina that was built. It didn't go all the way through the mountain, but it goes a good bit into the mountain. That was built during the Civil War by slaves. The Southerners were trying to build a connection up to, I think, like Asheville, to connect with a railroad there. And it's absolutely amazing to go into because it's so large, and I have looked at it and thought about the slaves that were working on that in, you know, essentially darkness, and it's just amazing to me how many of them must have been injured or killed in making that tunnel. The tunnel now, well, for some years was used by Clemson to age cheese, but it's just open now. I don't think anybody uses it for anything except maybe some college kids. But it's an interesting one to go into.
Well, there are quite a number of tunnel sites and other very arduous through the mountain construction sites where the story of the mortality of whether slaves or convict laborers after the Civil War needs to be known, that some lines they just buried workers killed in accidents or whipped to death, dying from exhaustion, poor food, health conditions, just dozens buried in unmarked graves. The human toll was just incredible.
Yes. I was also interested in your talking about blacks who were eating in dining cars having to be curtained off so that it didn't offend the whites. But it's interesting that probably the people who cooked the food and served the food were black, and that didn't seem to offend the whites at all.
No.
Thank you for this very interesting discussion today.
Well, thank you for the call. Other questions certainly are welcome. 333-9455. toll free, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Apparently there are a very few Jim Crow rail cars that still survive, and I think that actually, in fact, you were involved in the preservation of one of these cars out in California.
That's correct. Perhaps only about three dozen segregated cars still in existence, and that means cars that literally had a partition separating the car into two compartments, each one for the different race. And the Kentucky State Railroad Museum has one. There's a marvelous one down in Miami at the Gold Coast Railroad Museum. There's a beautiful wood one at the museum that I volunteer at, the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum outside of San Diego. The problem sometimes is getting the museums to forthrightly exhibit and interpret the cars and to tell the story of African American railroading, the good, the bad, and the ugly. But preserving a Jim Crow car is a very worthy enterprise in preserving the truth of our history.
Well, how do the accommodations differ on the two sides of the division?
Well, the accommodations sometimes didn't differ much at all. In the modern era, when they were modern streamlined stainless steel cars, they were pretty much equivalent. But on the older cars, often there was only one toilet for both sexes in the black compartment, two toilets in the white compartment. What was also not only an indignity but a safety issue was that the Jim Crow car was often an older, more decrepit, and less safe car. And custom decreed that the Jim Crow car was always the first passenger car behind the locomotive. Why? Because if there was a collision, passengers in the cars closest to the locomotive were more likely to be injured or killed. And secondly, in the era before sealed air-conditioned cars, passengers in the cars closest to the locomotive got much more of the smoke and the cinders and the nasty dirtiness that came from riding with the windows open. So all of this was deliberate, that the best, the cleanest, the safest was to be reserved for whites.
I want to go on and have you talk about the Pullman porters and their one big part of that story is their organizing, and that's really important to the history of organized labor in the United States. But before that, I'm just curious about, you talked earlier about the fact that on train crews, there were generally the firemen, the people who tossed the wood or the coal into the boiler, were black. The brakemen, which is an extremely dangerous job, were black. And then I'm sure in the rail yards, switchmen and people who did that kind of work, a lot of those guys were black. What sort of attempts were there, or were there attempts to organize those occupations?
Attempts by whites in those occupations?
No, I mean by blacks and those the black people who were doing that. I mean, did they try? Because I know that certainly there was organizing for white train engineers. Was there organizing for these other occupations if they were, predominantly held by blacks?
Yeah. Well, there were four, I believe, major unions for the operating crafts, enginemen, firemen, brakemen, and conductors. Those unions all formed after the Civil War and all had written into their constitutions that membership was reserved for Caucasians only. And it was only with those unions that the railroad companies negotiated union contracts, when the railroad companies even deigned to negotiate with workers. So blacks were excluded from those unions. They had, their only recourse was to establish their own independent black unions, but the Federal Railroad laws generally stipulated that whoever represented the majority of workers represented all workers, and using their clout, even where there were large numbers of black brakemen, the white brakemen were the ones who managed to get the contracts signed with the railroad companies. So unions played a terrible role in excluding blacks, in reducing the number of blacks, and in general, trying to ensure white monopolies.
Before, we talked about the fact that before the Civil War, that slave labor in the South was particularly important in laying track and building railroads, and that they also worked in these various jobs. They were brakemen, firemen. They helped to maintain the track, and apparently also worked as servants on the trains. That's something that continued once slavery was gone, and at least one employer, particularly Mr. Pullman, really had this idea that all of these people in those roles, the servant roles on the trains, he thought that that he would go all the way with African American employees in those roles.
Mm-hmm.
So what was it that motivated him to make that decision and deliberately recruit black people to do those jobs on for the trains?
Well, he saw that he was a pioneer in designing sleeping cars, as well as ultimately running the Pullman Company, the great empire of sleeping cars. And so in that very early stage, he foresaw that as rail journeys got longer and longer, that passengers would be willing to pay for a much more comfortable ride. And along with that, he very clearly felt that white passengers would be most comfortable being served by someone who was their social inferior, regarded as their social inferior, let's say. And he also knew that there was a large pool of recently emancipated former slaves who were looking for work, some of whom already had restaurant experience or food service experience or as a personal servant, valets or whatever. And in fact, he had no difficulty recruiting blacks in the years right after the Civil War. But it was clear he was going to make it an attractive journey, in part because one was receiving personal service from a servant, and most of these people couldn't have afforded servants in their own home. So their experience in life of being waited upon by a black person was usually on a sleeping car.
Mm-hmm. How was this experienced by the black people who were doing the work? Because you'd have to say, on the one hand, that, you know, being cast in this subservient role had really problematic aspects, but on the other hand, that was a good job.
It was a good job. It could be a good job monetarily if one had a preferred run, and one's patrons on any particular trip were generous. But it was a job that had many drawbacks. It was a job for which one typically put in a 300-hour work month. Do the math on that. That's working many hours. Not all those hours was one paid, preparing the car and waiting around for one's run. Some of those hours one wasn't paid. you had to endure racial insults and endure them in silence if you hoped to get a tip at the end of the journey. Might be a nice tip of a bill, might be no more than a dime. And so the income was irregular, and it was it placed blacks. Porters were part of the black middle class, not because of high income, but because of the prestige and status of the job, and people who wore good uniform and who traveled all over the country and rubbed shoulders with people in the white world.
And even though it was very difficult work and it could be very demeaning, it sounds as if within the African American community that was considered to be a good position, and that these people actually had status within the community.
They certainly did have status, but. I argue that it goes beyond the Pullman porters and waiters and cooks, that career railroad men, whether they were track workers, whether they were mechanics, whether they were laborers, firemen, brakemen, career railroaders were looked up to in their own communities. And you can find great deal of evidence of that in the company monthly employee magazines, where there were many profiles of both white and black workers, and black workers in all sorts of occupations were often noted for being church deacons or for being Masonic officers or having put their children all the way through high school, which was an achievement, or even children graduating from college. So to be a railroad man, a career railroad man, was a matter of pride. There's an old blues that says, when you marry, don't marry no farming man. Every day, Monday, hoe handle in your hand. When you marry, marry a railroad man. Every day, Sunday, dollar in your hand. So on a number of levels, a railroader, Pullman porter particularly, was a prize catch.
Talk a little bit about how things changed once the porters were organized, and we have this was some time later. So we're talking about here into the 20th century.
Yeah.
When the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters was organized by A. Philip Randolph, how did that change things, and did that make things better for people who had those jobs?
Well, it did make things better. It was over a decade before the Pullman Company was forced to negotiate with the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, and the Pullman Company never did want to negotiate with this black union, but finally had to do so in part as a result of New Deal labor legislation that was pro-labor. But it came late. By the time the Pullman Company negotiated the first contract with the porters and wage and benefit increases, we were in the depths of the Depression. Passenger traffic was down. It would very briefly pick up again during World War II, but then it slid dramatically after that. So the gains made were important psychologically, certainly, to the black community. It was a tremendous victory. It was symbolic of so much change and empowerment, but it came pretty late and didn't lead to certainly wealth for very many.
We have about 5-6 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Theodore Kornweibel. He's professor emeritus of African-American history at San Diego State University. He's author of a recent book. It's titled Railroads in the African-American Experience. It's a photographic journey. That's the subtitle. And it does have a lot of wonderful photographs in it, published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. So if you have a chance, you're in the bookstore, you might want to take a look at the book. And questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk at illinois.edu. When did the first black conductors appear?
They didn't appear again until the Civil Rights era. The Conductors Union was one of those all-white operating unions, and they were absolutely determined not to admit blacks. And again, because the conductor was, in a sense, the most prestigious role in the operating crafts. The conductor tells the engineer when to start the train. Train doesn't start without the highball from the conductor. The conductor supervises the other members of the crew. So that was clearly a job that was not for blacks, because they would be giving orders to whites. Hmm. Not until the Civil Rights era, and by that time passenger trains were much, much fewer. And so even with legislation, there just weren't very many jobs. Amtrak today is different. Amtrak is pretty colorblind, and you find quite a number of black conductors and passenger brakemen.
How we were talking about some of the things that men did, and all of the various things they did. They laid track, they maintained the track, they stoked the boilers, they took care of the dangerous jobs like brakemen. There were, of course, then men working as porters on the trains. There were men working as cooks and chefs in the dining car and so forth. How, what can you say something about the involvement of women? Because there certainly were women who even did track. There, I'm looking at some photographs here. There were even women who did track maintenance work.
Railroading was a man's occupation for a long, long time. And in the 19th century, even secretaries and clerks were almost exclusively men. So white women didn't break into railroading until the early 20th century in any significant numbers. And they broke into the white-collar or pink-collar occupations, secretarial work, and so forth. Black women were not admitted to those ranks because that would place them in too close social proximity to the white women. However, during both world wars, there were acute labor shortages in the manual labor sector, and so black women were brought in to do quite a variety of work, some of it quite heavy, as freight truckers, as moving crates and barrels with hand trucks at freight houses, working out on the tracks to keep the right-of-way clean and to dress the right-of-way. These were jobs that were not considered appropriate for white women. So black women suffered because of their race. They suffered because of their gender. Again and again in railroad history, you see we found that white women would not have been considered for some of the jobs that black women were put to. So during the World Wars, especially World War II, there was Rosie the Riveter making ships, and there was Rosie the Railroader helping to keep the railroads operating.
How, maybe you could also talk, and there's a chapter here that I think is really interesting that's about railroads and railroad images and discussion of railroads in black popular culture and African American music and other ways that fascinate, you know, a lot of people, regardless of color, are fascinated by trains. And I'm sure we're that was sort of always the case. What kind of significance did the train have for Black Americans in that sort of a way?
Well, early on, you think of the concept of the Underground Railroad, that a railroad symbolized the hope for freedom, the possibility of escape to something better. And that imagery continues all the way up into the blues. Railroads were also responsible for breaking up families, that men were away from their families for long periods of time. And so railroads, while offering opportunity perhaps, eroded family and community life. But railroads, and then to flip it once more, railroads signified something hopeful, that down the line something might be better, that whether it be a city, whether it be another state, that railroads could take one to hopefully a better life. So some rather complex imagery that entered Black consciousness and then was expressed in folklore, in folk songs, and eventually in Black literature.
Hmm. We're coming down to the point. Maybe we have a minute or so left. There's a lot in this book, and as I said, there's a lot of really wonderful photographs. So it's the kind of thing that people really need to experience by looking at the book. And if you're either interested in the history of railroading or in African American history or both, this is the kind of book that I really think that you're going to enjoy and you're going to like to take a look at. How do we finish up here? And I wonder, is there some sort of last kind of set of ideas that you might like to leave with folks?
Well, I would. And that is that most African American families have railroaders in their ancestry. I would argue that almost anyone, if they can probe back two or three generations, will find railroaders in their ancestry. That's a forgotten heritage, and I hope that my book will encourage Blacks to probe their family trees and find those railroaders. And if they worked for a major railroad like the Illinois Central, you go to the Illinois Central employee magazines, and every issue had pages and pages of profiles of Black railroaders. You might find your ancestor there, literally find your ancestor, but recapture that part of the Black heritage that's been too neglected and really unknown by far too many.
All right, and the book to look at would be the one that we have been talking about this morning, the title Railroads in the African American Experience, A Photographic Journey. Johns Hopkins University Press is the publisher and the author. Our guest, Theodore Kornweibel, is professor emeritus in African American history at San Diego State University. Hey, thanks very much for talking with us today.
It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and local news features, are available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus 580 will continue, so please stay tuned.
Hi, this is Masumi Rostad of the Pacifica String Quartet. Please join WILL 40 North Krannert and me for the new Docha Chamber Music Festival. We are playing at Radio Maria, Cakes on Walnut, and Jim Gould's in downtown Champaign, April 1st to 3rd. Docha will feature great music from some of our town's finest musicians, including Stefan Milenkovich, Dmitry Kuzov, Rudolf Hawken, and my group, the Pacifica Quartet. Admission is free. For more information, visit docha.org.
Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. Let's go right out to the pits where in Kansas City, May wheat is at 481 down 4 1/4. July, 492 1/4 down 4. May wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, 469 1/4 down 6 3/4. July, 482 3/4 down 6. May corn, 361 1/4 down 3 3/4. July, 372 down 4. December, 391 3/4 down 2 1/4. March of 2011, 405 unchanged. May soybeans, 960 unchanged. July, 968 1/2 up 1. November, 929 up 1 3/4. May soybean meal, 271.50 up 60. May soybean oil at 39.14 up 6. April live cattle, 95.42 1/2 down 30. June, 92.75 down 12 1/2. April feeders, 107.85 down 17 1/2. April lean hog, 70.30 down 82.